another day, another dollar makes you wonder where your money went.
Hi, this is Jack Spierko with yet another edition of the Survival Podcast. One man's view of the changing world and changing economic times, and what we can do to prepare for them to live a better life if times get tough, or even if they don't. Dictated as always on a 50-mile commute between Arlington and Frisco, Texas, as a guy in a large white Dodge Ram tries to attempt not allowing my VW Jetta TDI to enter the passing lane. Unfortunately for him, German engineering, and unfortunately maybe for us, German engineering has surpassed American engineering, and even my little 110-horsepower Jetta can accelerate that big Dodge Ram. Anyway, folks, enough of the little mini auto rant there, and had a big one in the show I recorded yesterday that was big enough that I had to edit it out, even though some of you like those. Today we're going to talk about something that's kind of been kicked off in my head by listening to a fellow podcaster. And there's a gentleman podcasting using Blogspot blog to host this podcast. It is the You Can Survive podcast at youcansurvive.blogspot.com. And I just recently listened to his second show, and he did it on what he called Micro Livestock. And I thought I'd give kind of my take on small stock. And I'm not a big small stock expert. I did keep some small stock as a child when we lived in the country in Pennsylvania. So I do have some direct experience with it. Right now, I don't really keep much of anything in my little suburban castle, simply because I'm not really making long-term plans for that place. So I'm somewhere between a 1 and 4 year evacuation plan, regardless of how good society either makes it or does not make it. I will be removing myself from the city life in the next 1 to 4 years. With that being the case, I'm trying to begin to lighten what I'm going to have to take with me rather than increase my burden. So that's going to kind of maybe limit my practical experience a little bit, but I'm going to give you some of the information that I've gained as I've been researching what to do myself when I eventually do make the move, and that'll give you some ideas for what you can do with small stock on different levels. I'm also going to talk, because I don't think I can fill out a whole show on just that. This is kind of an impromptu show. I don't have a big outline put together or anything for it, so I don't know that I can fill out a complete show on that. So I'm also going to talk a little bit about harvesting wild fish and game and using those to augment your protein needs as well, and some thoughts on that. And that's something I have a massive amount of experience with, and can kind of give me some guidelines between what's economically profitable in that world and what ends up being a loss. Doesn't mean you don't do it, because I hunt doves every year, and I spend more money in gas to get out to the dove fields than the doves are worth. And I do that because I'm a sportsman and I like to hunt. But there's other ways you can do things as a sportsman that are actually a net gain for you and your family. I'm going to talk a little bit about that. Before I do, I just want to comment briefly on what's going on out there with these clowns in our Congress and our Senate and our two clowns running for Republican and Democrat positions as President of the United States, Barack and John McCain, and this nonsense over the energy policy. Now, I want to clear out a lot of the crap that you're being told to tell you what's really going on here, how this is actually going to play out, because it's extremely transparent if you understand the background of what's going on here. Right now, neither side is incentivized to do anything to actually fix the problem in the short term. If that happens, then the other side can claim to be the reason that it occurred, and they have to debate who gets credit for the recovery. They would rather blame each other for the problem, because it's easier to make that stick on your opponent than try to take credit for the recovery while they've spent all this time saying it's not our fault. All right. So it's a problem with saying something's not your fault. If something's not your fault, if you had no control over it occurring in the first place, then how can you say you fixed it? And if you did fix it now, and you're the Democrats, well, why the heck didn't you fix it when you took over both branches of the House and the Senate, back in the last election? Why now? And, you know, you can't blame Bush then because, well, you did it now, so you could have done it then, so why didn't you do it like you promised? If you're the Republicans, it's like, well, you guys controlled everything for 6 years. Why didn't you do it then? So it's really hard for these guys to be in a situation where things are actually better. But it's really easy for both of them to blame each other, and that's the card they want to play right now. So this whole, you know, offshore drilling, folks, let me tell you how this works out. In not much more time, the ban on offshore drilling will expire, okay? And even though the president lifted the presidential executive order that it puts a ban on offshore drilling, the actual ban that's being enforced is preventing it from happening is going to expire. Once it expires, all right, the Bush administration is not going to be able to get it turned back on. Congress and the Senate are lazy right now and are worried about the election. They're not going to debate it. They're not going to touch it. It's a hot potato. They're going to leave it alone. All right? The next president will decide whether or not to push reinstating it. This allows both of these guys to not take a stand and vote in the Senate. You see, if they voted on it, if Pelosi didn't recess the Congress and the Senate didn't adjourn, and go on another vacation, like they have time to be on vacation while everything's in a crap basket, right? Then Barack and McCain would have both had to stand in front of the people and cast a vote. And they would either have to offend the American people who, by and large, support offshore drilling, or offend the very powerful environmental lobbyists. That's a position either one of them wants to take. So what they're doing right now is they're blaming each other for the problem. McCain's running around touting nuclear power and tapped all these alternative energy sources that he did nothing to really get started while he was in the Senate for decades. And Obama's out saying he's going to make us energy independent in 10 years, but he doesn't want to drill for a drop more oil. So I'm sorry, folks. We're not going to move to a point of energy independence if we don't pump and drill more of our own oil in the next 10 years. It ain't going to happen. Now, I know some of you guys are global warming guys. I'm going to talk about that later this week. I just wanted to kind of paint that picture for you, let you know what's really going on with these two clowns while they're pointing the finger at each other. It's all part of the plan. It's all part of the marketing. It's all part of the way that you're trying to get elected. All right. Well, enough of that. I just wanted to throw that in because it bugged me when I saw the two of them with their little, you know, talking head points this morning on the news as I was getting ready to leave the house. And I was thinking, you know, how many people actually are going, yeah, I believe that one, or yeah, I believe that one. They're both full of crap. Both of them have had opportunities to make a difference. Neither one of them has. Everybody's talked about energy independence from the 70s. We haven't done anything. We're not going to do anything until people snap and completely, totally turn over our government by getting rid of enough of incumbents to send a message that we want something done. So you guys watch the magic show, and you watch the sleight of hand, and you watch the class warfare, but I promise you, this time, next year, we're going to be no closer to energy independence than we are right now. It's not going to matter if it's McCain. It's not going to matter if it's Obama. In fact, if we're going to be closer, McCain's going to be the one that's going to get that done. If he does half of what he says he's going to do, my concern is he won't do any of it. All right. On to the main topic of the show, small stock, and maybe we'll do, like I said, maybe we'll do a little bit about harvesting wild game and fish. So I don't think it'd come to any shock to anybody that my favorite small stock animal, the one that I think makes just a tremendous amount of sense for anybody, is the chicken. The chicken is kind of a dirty, smelly bird, but it has so many attributes that you learn to love a smelly, dirty bird, and even somewhat of a noisy bird. Now, there's two main reasons that people would keep chickens. One would be for eggs, and one would be for both eggs and meat. And it's up to you whether or not you want to, harvest your chickens. And, hold on, folks, I'm just doing another lane change in front of a jerk. Anyway, harvest your chickens. It's a nice way of saying whether you want to take them out and kill them and eat them. And chickens are delicious animals, and I have no problem with eating chickens, and I eat chicken quite often. Personally, though, I'm not big on slaughtering animals that I raise and feed by hand. It's a thing for me that's a little bit tough, and I'm not soft at all, guys. I was 13 when I made my first boa kill. on a white-tailed deer, and I put my arms up to my armpits and slit its throat from the inside and pulled the gut pile out. I know that might sound kind of gross, but that's how you clean a deer. And something similar has to be done to every cow after it's been killed that's turned into a steak that you've eaten. So, there's a reality there, and I'm not averse to the reality. It's just that, I'll kill an animal quickly that has a chance to survive. I have a hard time looking into the eyes of an animal, even something as simple-minded as a chicken, that trusts me in taking its life. So my view for chickens really is for eggs. And I have good news for you. If you also only want chickens for eggs, you can keep a small group of hens, 4, 6, 12, depends on how many eggs you want, with no rooster whatsoever, and your hens will produce eggs for you. Infertile eggs that will never hatch, and I suggest highly, number one, don't get one chicken. Chickens are social animals, and they need a flock to feel comfortable, and they just need other chickens around them. They're a flock bird. To me, a minimum number is 3. 4 is probably better. But start with 3 or 4 birds if you've never kept chickens before. Get an assessment of their egg production level, because they grow fast and they begin to produce eggs very quickly. And, you could always get some more chickens. Getting rid of them may not be the easiest thing to do if you end up with too many. So start small and grow from there. When it comes to chicken coops, I mean, a chicken coop needs to be secure and safe at night, because there are animals out there, even if you live in the edges of suburbia, like raccoons, for instance, foxes, weasels in some situations, that will come kill your chickens at night. They absolutely will, and a raccoon will clean out a chicken coop faster than a fox, believe it or not. So you want to make sure whatever you keep them is secure and hard to gain entry by predators. And other than that, I mean, I'm going to let you do your own legwork on research and how to build chicken coops. But I am going to give you a couple ideas for chicken coops. One that I saw prefabricated is called the Igloo, I believe. I'm not sure exactly if that's the name right or not, but I'll put a link on the show notes at thesurvivalpodcast.com for this show so you can go look at this thing, because building your own version of it wouldn't be that hard. It's basically a long, low, narrow run of chicken wire that has shade on one end, open sun across the middle, and a chicken coop that looks very much like one of those dog igloo dog houses on the other end. It has a pan that slides out for removing the chicken manure, and that makes keeping up after your chickens pretty easy, and it's very easy to move. So you can, like, if you want your chickens to take care of bugs in a given area in a lawn and maybe do some weeding for you, because they'll eat damn near anything, folks, you kind of move it around as you need to. Very easy to move, and you can keep, I believe, 4 to 6 bands of hens in this little igloo thing. Well, building one of those yourself, a version of it, wouldn't be that hard. And so I'll send you, I'll put a link again. You can take a look at this thing and see if it's something you want to use or maybe purchase, or if it's something you want to emulate. Now, I came up with another idea, and I think this is a really slick idea. And it may be for a small flock, their actual chicken coop, their actual chicken house. Or for a larger flock, it may simply be a daytime containment system to let them do some help with you in your gardening. I have plans to build approximately 4-foot by 8-foot inside dimension raised beds all over the place when I move up to Arkansas. I've been doing some experimenting with raised bed gardening, working well for me here in Texas, and I know it's going to be my only real option on the land I have in Arkansas, because the soil there is silica-based. It's very, very poor. So I'm going to need to bring in topsoil, bring in compost, and put these beds in, and I'll build them over time until I have enough to provide maybe 50% or more of our vegetarian needs. Now, it just became immediately obvious to me that there was an opportunity here to build a chicken containment system that was designed to sit on top of those boards that make those raised beds, bolt down to it so it's secure and safe if you wanted to put a little chicken house inside there for them to go in at night and lay their eggs and whatnot. And be able to, when a bed has run its course and it needs to rest for a while, it needs to be weeded and picked through and dug under, set that little chicken house coop on top of that raised bed and let the chickens live there for a while. What they'll do is all the little stubble of plants and whatnot like that and weeds and everything, they'll eat it, right? They'll also do what chickens do, which is poop. They poop like crazy. They'll poop right on in the bed, and I can let them sit there for, you know, anywhere from a couple weeks to a couple months, and then move them to a new bed. And I can just continue and continue to do that over and over and over again. Because two people could easily pick up a structure of that size, move it, set it down on the next next bed, and move the chickens to a new location. This is exactly what I think I'm going to do, and I'm going to probably do it with a flock of about 4 bantam birds to start out. And if bantam is a new word for you, bantam chickens are just smaller chickens. They eat less, okay, and they get they're a little bit smaller and they're a little easier to take care of. But they lay eggs that are close to the size of a regular chicken egg, so you get more for less input. So chickens, great animal, great bird. Those are just some of my thoughts on how to do it. And my idea of this portable chicken house that's designed to sit on top of your raised beds came from an article on Backwoods Home that was a little bit more elaborate. This is where a guy built a chicken coop with a garden on both sides of the chicken coop, a very large garden, and simply gave them an entire season running that garden area, and then moved them to the next side the next year and would keep rotating his crops back and forth. This is kind of a smaller, simpler way to do it on a smaller scale, because I don't plan on having a flock of several dozen birds. I want a few birds to produce maybe a couple fresh eggs a day for me so that we can have good, fresh protein every morning for breakfast and maybe a few extra eggs to make some baked goods and things like that. So that's kind of going to wrap up my thoughts on chickens. Another small stock that I think has a lot of promise, I don't have a lot of planning right now myself for these unless I get over my my issue with killing things that eat from my hand, but it's rabbits. And I do love to eat rabbit. It's an incredible meal to me. It's a great protein source, extremely nutritious, and again, just delicious. It's just a delicious food. If you've never tried rabbit, you know, avail yourself of the opportunity to try rabbit. But rabbit has a lot of promise for the small-scale homesteader. They can be kept in very small areas. They're completely quiet. They produce a tremendous amount of manure. And one thing about their manure is it doesn't have to be composted at all. You can put it directly into your plant beds, and it does amazing things for vegetables in your gardens. And I've had friends that kept rabbits that don't really garden, and I've been able to get manure from them, and the results are spectacular, to say the least, of using rabbit manure as a form of fertilizer. So you might even, if you weren't going to eat rabbits, keep a couple of them around just for their manure and maybe keep them as pets. So that's up to you. When it comes to actually eating rabbits, you don't really want to eat adults. They get kind of tough and they get a little bit too large. And I mean, it's something you can't eat kind of a retired breeder. And you probably should if you're going to retire it and you don't really want to keep it around anymore. But you're going to have to, like, stew it or something to deal with how tough the meat is. Generally, people eat what they call fryers, and it's almost right at the point that they're weaned. Maybe you feed them a few weeks after they're weaned, and they get into about a one-third to one-half of their growth. And at that point, a lot of the meat rabbit breeds are 3 to 4 pound animals, and it's a good time to harvest them. Nice thing about rabbits, if you've ever hunted rabbit and skinned a rabbit, you know they're really easy to skin. So they're another great animal with a lot of potential. I want to talk about one other thing that I think really bears a lot of consideration when it comes to small scale stock and keeping at home. And that's what I call small-scale aquaculture, or basically raising fish or some other type of aquatic species. Now, there's a couple ways to do this. The simplest way would be if you have land that's big enough to put in a decent-sized pond, even a quarter-acre pond, especially if you can get some depth to it, will really do wonders with raising and growing various different types of fish. If you're in southern climates where it doesn't freeze, or you're going to do all your harvesting before freeze, or you can keep a tank, let's say, in a greenhouse type of environment where it doesn't freeze, tilapia are a great farm-raised fish. They bear a lot of consideration in doing that. But I think for a lot of people, they're going to be in environments where they're not going to be able to completely control the temperature, and they may be using a pond for fish growth. You're better off sticking with species that are native to your area because they are adaptable to the situation. Kind of the ones that are the easiest to grow to food size quickly are channel catfish, and hybrid sunfish. The main reason I say hybrid sunfish is you can purchase males only, or you can purchase varieties that won't breed. And they can be grown in a season to bigger than the size of an average man's hand with a proper feeding regimen. Sunfish are incredibly good eating sweet white meat. They are very small animals compared to a lot of other fish, even when they're big. You know, you're still talking about relatively small fillets. But they grow well. They overwinter well. They're easy to get onto a pelletized feed or something like that, supplemental feed. And they make a lot of sense. Catfish are probably the perfect North American fish for farming if you have a big enough area for them. You can grow them in a season to 14 inches around that size, which is about a pound and a half, which is just about perfect for a harvest size. They're easy to get on a pellet feed again. So with a pond, it really makes things easy as far as stocking your pond, and you can even do some little recreational fishing to harvest as needed, and you can use nets if you feel that you need to. But I'm not going to go into pond management because that could be a whole show, and I'll probably do one someday on it. I've got some practical experience with small pond management. But, you know, that's just an idea, and it's something I'm going to look at doing in Arkansas. I plan on buying a little bobcat machine or a little front-end loader when I move there, and there's potential from a seasonal creek down at the backside of my land to possibly put a pond in. It may or may not work. The area around Hot Springs is notorious for not holding water due to the geothermal activity, and my house actually sits on the rim of an ancient volcano, so we'll see whether or not it's going to be possible. So it's just one thing that, you know, I've considered doing. Another thing that I've read about is this, the old catfish in a barrel, where this guy raised 50 channel catfish to a eating size in one season, and he fed them almost completely on worms that he also farmed and fed kitchen scraps that made compost for the garden. Sounds like a great idea. I know a guy that tried it. I've got a link to his blog on my site. It's called Clark's Homestead. You can go there and link off to him. Take a look at his attempt. He ended up in the hospital with his wife while he had a child being born. A bill got paid late. His electricity got shot off, and all his fish died on him in the 90-plus degree heat without the pump running. So it didn't work out. And as I read his chronicle, I'm wondering whether or not it's really feasible. Definitely, if you're going to think about doing like a very small-scale aquaculture product, read his chronicle, because you'll see some ideas that he had that he tried that resulted in some fish dying. There were some ideas that I had that would have resulted in some fish dying, and some things that will save you some grief. So take a look at his article. That's really great. But another thought of mine was building either a small pond that holds several hundred gallons and raising either hybrid sunfish or catfish in that pond, like a typical garden pond that we see in so many places now that can be done with a liner, or even possibly decking around to kind of hide what it is and make it fit your landscape better. One of the small above-ground pools that can be set up by an individual in a day. They have their own filter system. I don't know how well that filter would work, but it seems like the pump at least can be used to go through a biological filtration system, and it would be kind of a self-contained immediate solution. And again, you could raise channel catfish, hybrid sunfish, or just go out to your local lakes and streams and harvest sunfish that are not quite big enough yet, bring them home and drop them in. I've heard concerns that if you do that with wild fish, they won't adapt. At one time, I put a dozen bluegill into a very large fish tank where people walked by every day. Took them about a week to get in the swing of things. They went straight on the regular tropical fish food. They had no problem adapting whatsoever. And that was in an area with a lot of commotion, no place to hide other than the few plants that were in the tank. So I have no concerns about that whatsoever. You may need to check with your local law to make sure that that's acceptable. But if you can harvest the fish legally, to me, if I harvest it and take it home and eat it, or I harvest it and take it home and put it in a tank, really, that's my business. So that's my thought on kind of small-scale aquaculture. So these are just three types of livestock, I guess you'd call them, that you can grow at home. And they really are something to consider. And there's many other options. Maybe I'll do a show on that in the future. I wanted to talk, though, just a little bit about fishing and harvesting directly from nature and the advantages and the disadvantages of that. There is some real advantage to just going out and fishing. And there's many different methods, and maybe I'll do a whole show where I talk about some really, like, high-volume fishing methods on how you can get maybe a little bit more profitable, if you want to call it that, with your fish harvesting. But, I mean, the biggest one is obvious. When you go out and fish, you don't have to care for the fish. You don't have to take care of them. You don't have to feed them. You don't have to be responsible for them. They take care of themselves. You go out, you harvest them, you eat them. So you don't have any investment in the fish itself. The problem is that it's getting more and more expensive to just go fishing. Let's look at, we'll forget about what you pay for your fishing pole, because you buy it once, and any tackle and any equipment. Let's just look at putting gas in your boat and your truck. For most people, unless you live really close to the lake, say you're going to burn 5 miles of gas in your truck to pull your boat, and 5 gallons of gas in your boat. And that's going to be minimal for a lot of these bass fishermen that don't even keep what they catch. They might burn 20 gallons of gas just in their boat in a day. And they might burn 20 gallons or more of gas driving to and from the lake. Let's just say 10 gallons of gas. 10 gallons of gas today, at, let's round it off, $4, $40. Now, if you go, you come home, and after you fillet the fish you catch, you come home with 5 pounds of fillets, you just paid $8 a pound for catfish that you could have went and bought at the store for less. And a lot of times, like when we look at gardening, we go, well, you know, I got cleaner, better produce. And unfortunately, you know, harvesting catfish from our lakes today, it may not be as healthy as eating farm-raised, just honestly, with the amount of pollution that we have. So you don't even have that advantage. So there's a limit to how profitable this really is as a way of saving money and actually being more self-sufficient because of what it costs to do. There are a couple ways to minimize that. One is if it's legal in your state, specifically with catfish, taking up either jug fishing or trot lining. And using a small boat that uses very little gas and finding an area close to home and burning as little gas as possible and maximizing your harvest every time you go out. I won't get into jug lining and trot lining right now. Just I'm going to tell you that in a lot of states it's legal and a lot of states it's not. It really depends on what the population of, you know, catfish and other rough species of fish are in your state, whether or not people legalize that. The reason it's illegal in some states is because it's very, very effective, and it allows for a very large harvest. Now, we have such massive populations of channel catfish in Texas, and relatively low angler interest compared to other species like crappie and bass and things like that, that we have a very high limit on our channel catfish down here of I believe it's 25. And so 25 a day. And, you know, with a trot line or with a jug set, you can go out and you can routinely put 25 fish in the boat. That starts to get the volume up there to where it's definitely a net return if you minimize your travel time and things like that. And you don't have to spend all the time on the lake because the devices do a lot of the fishing for you. So that's something to consider. Another species of fish that I have really found to be a profitable fish, if you want to call it that, is a white bass. I've learned a lake that's less than 10 minutes away from my house fairly well, to where I can go out most times of the year, burn very little gas in my boat, which uses very little gas, it's got a small motor on it, and almost always catch a limit of white bass, which is, again, 25 fish. Now, white bass are not as great as catfish for survivalists because they don't smoke well. I smoked white bass one time. I'll never do it again. But they fry well, and they broil very well. And there's a lot of things that you can do with them. They're an easy species of fish to catch once you learn how to find them. The skill of a white bass fisherman is to locate a school. And they're in different areas, and they're in different patterns all through the years. The temperature, lake levels, and pressure changes, and they go through breeding cycles and whatnot. They're always moving to different places. They're like little wolf packs. They're out there, ambushing shad. So they basically follow the shad. You learn those patterns, and you can motor out to a hump. You don't need any bait at all. You use a slab lure. Bounce the bottom at a lot of times of the year, and you can pull in 25 fish in a couple hours. That's something that I've done a lot of, and it's a great species for that. Some of you guys that live next to big lakes that have stripers on them, you have striper populations where you can almost do the same thing. Generally, your limits are lower, but you're talking about bigger fish. Same thing with hybrids, which are striper and white bass crosses. Learn your laws. Don't go over your limit. Don't use methods that you should for fishing. That's just my thoughts on, you know, some ways that you can make fishing a little bit more profitable. Moving into hunting just a little bit here, a lot of guys seem to think they're going to be Daniel Boone in a post-apocalyptic world. okay? And I don't think it's very rational, because I think if you get to a point where people are really starving, living off the land is going to become hard because people are going to rape it. And they're going to go out there and just harvest everything, and it's going to be very, very low populations. But right now, and for the foreseeable future, it looks like our game populations are pretty good. I'm going to briefly talk about four species that I see as ideal species to harvest in a way that is beneficial to you financially if you can figure out how to do it right. The first one is the squirrel. And you may be a little bit squeamish on eating a squirrel. If you are, let me just say try it. If you don't want to try it, fine, I understand. But squirrel is a good eating animal. It tastes a lot like rabbit. They're a little tougher to clean, but once you learn how to skin a squirrel, you can do it pretty quick. The beauty of squirrels is they're everywhere. There's almost no place in the United States that they don't have squirrels that can be hunted. Mostly fox and gray squirrels are the primary species that hunters target. And the beauty of them is that most farmers and landowners will grant you permission to hunt squirrels for no fee. Even if they're people that charge a fee for big game hunting that have leases on land or what have you, they'll let you in there on the times that it's not big game season to hunt squirrels for free if you just go and ask. So that's one of the beauties, is how easy it is to access them. They have high bag limits. You do not have to be very skilled. I mean, I consider myself a fairly skilled squirrel hunter, and there are techniques that I've learned over the years, and I've started hunting squirrels when I was 12 years old, and I can go out and harvest squirrels when other people can't. But in years where their population is high, anybody that can shoot a .22 accurately or a shotgun accurately and has the time and access to places where squirrels are can go out and harvest some squirrels. So they're a good animal just to put in the game bag. And with high bag limits that they have, like in Texas, it's 8 animals. So 8 animals a day. So if I could find a very close local place to harvest squirrels, I could harvest 8 a day during the season, which is about 80% of the year down here. In fact, I think parts of Texas, they don't even have any seasons at all on squirrels. So that tells you just the abundance of them. Up in Arkansas, there is a season, but it's pretty generous. It's a spring and a fall season. So squirrels, definitely something to put on your radar for harvest from the woods. White-tailed deer, I think that they are a great species also. And, maybe I'll do a whole episode on hunting someday, or maybe just hunting deer. But the big issue with deer is that when you shoot a deer, you have something. You're not talking about one meal, you're talking about multiple meals. And in some states, limits are pretty high. My area of Arkansas, 4 deer a year. Places that I hunt in South Texas are 5. 5 deer is a lot of meat in the freezer. Deer aren't as big as some people seem to think they are as far as how much meat you produce out of them. But 4 or 5 deer produce a lot of meat. The problem is it's getting harder and harder to find places where you can be successful hunting deer without paying a fee for it. But if you can find either public land that you can learn well and hunt well, or you can find a place that you can lease or gain permission to without breaking the bank, that's probably the most profitable big game animal to hunt in America. Other large game like moose and elk, obviously you get more meat, but it's a lot more difficult to gain access to them. Where white-tailed deer are prevalent in Texas, they're prevalent in Maine. They're prevalent in Florida. There's white-tailed deer and subspecies of white-tailed deer across the western states. There's almost no place that you can go in the continental United States where you can't find white-tailed deer, or let's say mule deer, which are very similar species. They're different in a lot of ways, but from a standpoint of hunting them, they're very similar. Or maybe black-tailed deer in the extreme west coast area up in Alaska. So deer, obviously something that makes a lot of sense. The next one is the rabbit. Rabbit's a lot like squirrel in its advantages. High bag limits, generous seasons, and generally easy to gain permission to go hunt them from landowners. Even if they are landowners, they generally charge a lease fee for big game. And so that's something that definitely I would say consider in your wild harvesting is the humble rabbit. And as much as I don't want to keep rabbits and harvest them when they're kind of trusting and being fed by hand, I don't really have any problem whatsoever about going out and doing some cottontail hunting and kicking some brush piles. And it's a lot of fun, and you can't take the fun factor out of hunting. It's something that's really cool. And then the last one I want to talk about, I don't get to shoot these things anymore, but I just want to throw an oddball game animal out there. It's not really a game animal. They're considered a vermin. But there's an animal known as the groundhog, and either you know exactly what a groundhog is or you don't. It depends on where you live. If you live anywhere where groundhogs live, you've seen them. They're in fields everywhere. Farmers generally hate them. A lot of their stock, like their cattle, will end up breaking legs in their holes, or a farmer will be doing some work in a wood line and end up doing what's called a one-legger down a groundhog hole, where you actually fall in a groundhog hole. And if you do that when you're stepping over a blown-down branch and you hit yourself where men really don't want to hit themselves, you'll hate groundhogs for the rest of your life. And a lot of landowners feel that way. And they are generally not protected, and they're open season all year round for shooting because they're considered vermin. And in spite of that, their populations are doing well, so don't go Greenpeace with the groundhog. He's going to do well. He's not going to be exterminated. And I was shooting them a lot in my teenage years, especially once I got a car at 16. I would drive around these various farms where in the Pennsylvania Dutch country. I'd look for groundhogs. I'd go find the farmer that owned the land and say, hey, you've got some groundhogs, can I shoot them? And almost without question, they would always not only say, shoot them, but please shoot them. And I would go shoot them, and I got permission to hunt a lot of farms during regular deer season and small game season simply by going out and shooting groundhogs in the summertime. After I did this for a while, though, I started looking at these fairly large animals that I was throwing away and thought, you know, I should give eating these things a try. So I skinned just the back legs and the back meat off of a couple of them, had my grandmother throw them in a pressure cooker to tenderize them a bit, and then I grilled them. Surprisingly good meat, tasted a lot like pork, or very lean, more pork, like more like wild boar. Maybe a little gamier than even wild boar, and not quite the exact same thing, but it's the best thing that I can point you to is kind of a wild boar roast. Is what the stuff tastes like, and I'm thinking if it was aged a little bit, it might come out a little better. I ate quite a few of them after that. I was young and impetuous, so I would eat, you know, go out and shoot one or two and take some of the meat from them and eat it right away. Never tried aging it. Now that I live down here, I couldn't find a groundhog anywhere. They just don't live down here. But it's something to consider, and it just kind of opens your mind to maybe other possibilities. I watched a show called Bizarre Foods with Andrew Zimmerman. He eats some things I would never eat, but a couple days ago I saw him do a show on the Gulf Coast, and he was eating possum and raccoon. And I've never actually eaten possum or raccoon, but my immediate thought was, well, I'd eat that. I'd give it a try. So, you know, think about those other oddball animals that have high season limits, that are easy to find close to cities and towns, and maybe consider them as part of your protein regime. Maybe you don't have to wait for the apocalypse to be willing to give raccoon or groundhog a try. Just something to think about. So I know this is kind of a broad-reaching show. We started out talking about the presidential election. We talked a little bit about different options with small stock. And we rounded off a little bit about hunting. It's just kind of giving you kind of a, well, I guess you'd call like a smorgasbord of my thoughts on these things. I'm going to do some deeper shows into them in the future, but I wanted to get another show out this week. I've got a couple that I'm working really hard collecting data for, and I'm not ready to do those yet. As I said before, I don't want to do a show before it's ready, so I knew this was something I could just kind of rattle off and go through. So I hope you guys enjoyed the show. If you have any questions about any of this stuff, please post them on the blog. Please go by the Survival Podcast if you haven't yet. Join our listener appreciation contest where you can win a free iPod Nano or maybe something else cool. We look forward to that. And keep the suggestions and ideas coming. And as I keep telling you, when you suggest the show, if you don't hear it come out right away, don't think I'm not going to do it. I'm going to do just about any show that's suggested, as long as I can do it without getting myself into legal trouble. But I'm going to have to take the time to do the research to make sure that I collect it updated to do a good show for you guys. Again, this is Jack Spirico with the Survival Podcast, here to help you learn how to live a better life if times get tough. Or even if they don't.
You wonder where your money went. You can scream and you can holler. It really doesn't matter, 'cause it all gets spent.